Good afternoon. The bulk of Cabinet's time today, and I'm sure will be next week, is finalising the budget. So there's not a lot I can talk to you about that. Obviously, appreciate this time. But I just want to start by giving an update just in terms of the earthquake. So tomorrow marks 6 weeks since Christchurch was hit by a 6.3 magnitude earthquake. I want to take this opportunity to take stock of how the government has responded so far, and where we're going from here in terms of rebuilding. I can now advise that the Crown has to date spent in the order of $1.1 billion responding to both the September and February earthquakes in Canterbury. Around $800 million of this has been for residential claims paid out by EQC. Around $175 million has been spent on wage subsidy and job loss cover packages so far. There are a number of other spending areas I won't detail here today, but obviously there's a lot more spending to come. The Crown accounts for the 8 months to the 28th of February released today provide some general comments on the quake and include a $1.5 billion initial EQC cost for the second earthquake. All of this points to the fiscal challenges we face at Budget 2011. I'm advised that the cordon in Christchurch CBD has gradually reduced, although some areas are still no-go zones. Almost all schools have reopened, albeit with some disruption at some sites, and nearly all households have power and running water. EQC is busy processing claims from the 22nd February earthquake, and all they now have 282,000 claims on the books from both quakes. Last week, the Earthquake Recovery Minister and I launched the new Canterbury Earthquake Recovery Authority in Christchurch, CERA, in short, to coordinate the rebuilding in collaboration with the city. The private sector has also stepped up with a number of large corporates showing their confidence in the future of Christchurch. For example, ASB has launched a $250 million package for the SME sector, and Coca-Cola Amatil's decision to reinvest in building a state-of-the-art plant in the city. The feedback to my office is then to go by. We'll see much more of this in the weeks ahead. So 6 weeks on, we can say that considerable progress has been made restoring basic services and getting the institutions in place to coordinate what is going to be a massive long-term rebuilding task. We can also say that the business community is showing that it has confidence in the future of the region. There's a long way to go, but I repeat, the rebuilding of the city is one of the government's highest priorities. We will continue to provide the resources to make this happen over the coming weeks, months and years. In terms of the House, we'll be back in session this week. It's government's intention to make further progress in the Financial Markets Bill, the Securities Trustees and Statutory Supervisors Bill and the Legal Services Bill. In terms of ministerial activity and my activity this week, tomorrow, Wednesday, I'm in Wellington. Thursday, I'm a regional visit to Taupo. Friday, I'm in Christchurch, and on Saturday, a couple of events in Auckland.
The welfare rescue package has got about 67,000 people on it at the moment. How realistic is it that in the 7 weeks or when it runs out, that tens of thousands of people will be transferred onto the dole? Is it a realistic position?
Look, I don't think it is. I don't think there's any credibility in the numbers that Clayton Cosgrove has sort of pulled out of the year. There's no basis to the logic he's putting together. I mean, what we do know is companies are working very hard to establish their plans now. Quite a number of companies are working with the business mentors to see what their future plans might be. But just to give you one example, I think the job loss part of the package, which had about 7,500 people on it, now only has about 3,000 people on it and have transitioned into jobs. So, yes, there's obviously a significant state of flux in Christchurch, a great deal of uncertainty. We see that with the likes of the Christchurch Casino, but it's still very hopeful that they'll be back in business and operating by the end of May. So a lot of companies still unsure, but people are starting to get jobs and moving.
So you think it'll be thousands rather than tens of thousands?
Yeah, I don't know exactly, but that's more my sense.
What could you hope that there are jobs down there, sorry? Because from anecdotally, from when you talk to people down there, you know, some of these business owners haven't yet got into the CBD to look into their businesses to see what they can do.
Yes.
So what gives you that hope that 60,000 people will be employed in a few weeks' time?
Yes, so to start with, by definition, just the fact that a business can't get into its former premises in the CBD doesn't mean it's not operating. I mean, lots of businesses in that position can't get into the CBD, but actually they've set up in Wickham or Addington or somewhere else. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that a lot of those people on those schemes are a payment that the government is making to keep the business company together. But that's a transitioning basis while that company gets back on its feet. So one, they're not one and the same thing. People are going to necessarily lose their job. Now, we all accept that some business activity has to stop. Some people will lose their job. And the impact of that could be many and varied. Some people will leave Christchurch and seek employment somewhere else. Some people will change industries and change jobs. Others obviously will go on the dole. There will be an increase there. But there's also quite a lot of economic activity coming out of even the early stages of
you won't extend your package after that, this last extension. You won't go for a third phase.
The first is in 14 weeks. So it's a 14-week program from February 22nd. What you can see is we're transitioning that phase to zero for the business continuity scheme. But there are other schemes that we are looking at. There are other things that we're working on. There might be a different phase from simply giving cash, but we're working hard to get those businesses to be out in operation.
What level of unemployment in Christchurch would be unacceptable to you?
Well, anything above zero at one level is technically unacceptable, because obviously we want people to be employed, but I think we need to accept that in the short term there will be a bulge that's created by the fact that there are people whose homes and possessions are in Christchurch, and their families are engaged in schools or wherever it might be, but their job has actually gone. There's also a great recognition from people in Christchurch that while they're going through a very difficult phase at the moment, the future is very bright for Christchurch. There's going to be a huge amount of economic activity. There's $20 billion of capital spent there, so there's timing issues. I don't know. In terms of the unemployment benefit, the number of people actually on a benefit in Christchurch, the number I saw this morning was very approximately 5,500. That doesn't include the people that are on the job loss schemes and things like that, but it was about 5,500. And the numbers of people we have on the benefit have been reducing every week. I see those numbers.
Would the government look at doing more around retraining, though, to ensure that people are perhaps in other jobs that they lose and then in a position to pick up the new works? The new works clearly going to be in construction.
They are all the sorts of issues we're considering, yes.
Mentioning the casino, possibly resuming operation by the end of May, what are your hopes in terms of the 500 jobs that appear to be at stake just at the moment?
Well, I guess mine would be the same aspirations that the company has, which is it wants to get back into business as soon as it can. It's actively encouraging its staff to stay with it. It's paid the workforce for 6 weeks. It's now encouraging them to take annual leave. It is saying if anyone takes annual leave but decides to take another job and therefore make themselves redundant, they'll still be eligible for that 4-week redundancy package. Obviously, they have a site-specific licence, so it's very difficult for them to go and operate from somewhere else. Their issue is not so much the structural damage to the casino, which I understand is not significant. It's the damage to the Copthorne Hotel over the road and access to the casino. Therefore, their building is blocked off. But a lot of work is going into what can happen on that site. And we remain hopeful that casino will be back up and running as soon as practical. Yeah.
You seem to be less optimistic about the possibility of operating at different premises than Jerry Brownlee. What is that?
I wouldn't say that. I'm just saying that it has a site-specific licence. It is possible for us under the SERA legislation to go and change that licence. And again, all of that might occur if it was established that they couldn't get back into their existing premises for a very long period of time. I'm sure they want to restart somewhere else. But casinos have a lot of equipment that's set up in a specific place. There are community concerns about casinos. They're not something you just put absolutely anywhere. So I'm just simply saying, logistically, it's not as easy to move as my businesses.
Would you be happy to fast track them, though, too? I mean, if they wanted, if they came to you and said, we want you to help us move, there's 500 jobs on the line, would the cabinet be willing to say, yes, let's do this quickly?
Well, I think the track record of this government is it's done everything it can for the people of Christchurch on the back of very difficult conditions to try and keep people in the work, preserve jobs, and make sure that people can meet their liabilities, and that includes the same. But as I say, for what they tell me, they still remain optimistic as best they possibly can that they'll be back in the premises by the end of May.
Looking at those suburbs and streets that we've talked about over the last month or so, you said a few weeks ago, I think, you'd have a steer by now whether some of those streets could be rebuilt, whether those suburbs would need to be evacuated. Where's it at with that? What do you know?
Yes, the best I can say is that information is firming up. Tonkin and Taylor are providing the Minister with reports, and they're not in a position to give them finalised data, but it's getting closer.
Have you had any reports back on, I can't remember the technical term for it, but the laser imaging of the depth of how far the land has subsided and so on. Have you had that? What does that tell you?
I think he's had some initial reports on that. There's some station I've confused with Jerry because he's got the technical terms, but it moves around and it's still apparently after these events. LIDAR, that's it, yes, well, LIDAR data, that takes a little bit more time, but I mean, look, there's certainly indications there's been substantial movement in the past.
But does that
throw
a question mark over their future viability?
Could do, but I mean, there's nothing new there, that's been the position we've established for some time, but there's been, the eastern suburbs have been very prone to liquefaction, there's been quite significant movement. People on the ground will tell you that.
Because there's been a lot of work building up the riverbanks, particularly the Avon, sandbagging and so on. I mean, that would suggest that the flooding risk has increased.
That's the fear factor, yes.
In regard to the government guarantee scheme, what new information do we know now in regard to supplementary funding that you didn't know before?
Nothing really. I mean, basically what the government's announced today is that the value of South Canterbury's assets are lower than what we originally thought at the time, by tune about $330 million. It's important to understand what that is. It's related party loans made by South Canterbury Finance. So it's not the value, for instance, of the helicopter line or the scales business. At the time that the receiver took up the accounts, or the responsibility for the accounts, they were unable to establish the value of a lot of those interrelated or related party loans. And so now he's had an opportunity to work through that, and he's established that there's less value there than he originally thought.
Given
so
the economic environment that we're in at the moment, how frustrating is it that another $300 million will
be going
into this?
Well, it's frustrating, but I think it's important to understand we inherited the problem through the previous deposit guarantee scheme. It shows you the magnitude of the losses and also the significance of the corporate failure at South Canterbury Finance, and obviously that's an ongoing process. And I would make one point, because others have made it to the contrary, and not speaking from a position of knowledge, no potential bid that the government could have accepted for the assets of South Canterbury Finance would have helped the government had we accepted that bid. All of the bids had a provision for us to still be responsible for any bad assets when the value of the book would be established. So it wouldn't have made any difference whether we accepted the bid or not.
So of the $1.6 to $1.8 billion that the government had to outlay to underwrite the retail deposit guarantee scheme on South Canterbury Finance, how much of that money does the government now expect to recoup?
Well, I think the total loss moves from about $800 million in gross terms to about $1.1 billion. We can then take off that the fees that we've moved through the scheme, which are in the order of about $500 million. So I think the whole scheme has cost us about $600 or $700 million net, on the best information we get.
How confident are you that there won't be other unpleasant surprises further down the track when it comes to South Canterbury's assets?
Well, I think the receiver's done a lot of good work in the last few months and a lot of due diligence, but it's still their best estimate on what those assets might be worth if they were sold. So I can't rule out that they're further losses.
Prime Minister, just on the situation that the Labour Party finds itself in with the party list.
Yes.
What are your feelings about the party list in terms of electoral law effectively chaining you to a list from 2 years ago? Should there be some tinkering there to make it a little bit more flexible as to who you can get at this last stage to save the sort of machinations behind the scenes?
Yeah, so who the Labour Party encourages or discourages back into Parliament is a matter for them. Frankly, I don't want any of them on their list of my party, but they're entitled to have theirs coming in. But the matter of MMP is something that's subject to a referendum at the end of the year. Public have a chance to express their view on that then.
But do you think that the list, the way it's set at the moment, is a little too stringent and you've got to stick to what you decided way back in 2000?
Well, I don't think so, because political parties go out on election day and say to the New Zealand public, here is the list, this is what you're voting for, this is what you get if you give us a certain percentage of the vote. So it's actually all part of the transparency of democracy that we actually tell them who's on that list and where they're at. Otherwise, by definition, we could have the list all over the show and then just add our convenience to change it whenever we want it.
Do you think it's an abuse, though, of MMP and the list that a party could say, don't want you, or what have you, thanks?
Well, it's technically false advertising at one level, isn't it? But,
But isn't the rules of the National Party line that your board can basically look at that and put on this position?
Sure, it's with all political parties, but at the end of the day, I think the legal rules are you follow the list as it's prescribed. But if you can encourage someone not to come back or to come back to an office, that's a matter for the party and for your relationship with the public. It can and might happen. I mean, a number of years on, some people might say, look, the appeal of coming back for a few months is not what it was.
Returning to the issue of transparency for democracy, why is the SIS legislation being heard in secret? What have you got to hide?
Well, they're nothing to hide. Any submission is free to be released. In fact, some people will release them, their submissions are owned by the sort of committee. Secondly, that is the standard practice under which the law is established, to actually have submissions the select committee process heard in public is what's actually unusual, and that requires unanimous support of the committee. Now, there's good reason for that. There was a reason why the last time they heard something in public it seemed more appropriate, and there's reasons why the current one doesn't seem as appropriate. But that's not unusual. That is the way the law is drafted.
Does it not create a perception that you have got something to hide? Isn't this a matter that, you know, it would be best to be straight up front?
Well, that's not a matter for, if you want to take that view, I don't share that view, but if you want to take that view, that's not a matter for the current SIS legislation that's going through Parliament. That's a matter for the current Act and whether that should be changed. Because, as I say, the default position is all community work for the SIS is heard in private.
With regard to the submission from Keith Locke, he's written to you asking that it be heard in public session. What is your response going to be?
No.
Why are you turning it down?
Well, for the same reasons. I support the view that legislation is established under, which is it's not necessarily in the best interest to do so.
He says that none of his evidence is likely to break or breach national security.
I'm sure, but he's free to release that to the public. There's nothing stopping him.
But shouldn't the way that the members of the committee question them also be open to public scrutiny?
I don't believe that's in the best interest, no.
Will you be putting out a list of who is appearing before the committee this week?
Yes, I'm sure they will. That's the committee, but again, there's no secret coming for them. Anyone's free to release their submission. In fact, the select committee will encourage people to release their submissions.
Colin Glenner from the interview at the weekend says, you've got no blueprint for the economic recovery of the country. Do you remember him telling me that at the business roundtable?
No, I don't remember that, no. He was at the business roundtable, but I don't think he made those comments, no.
And do you have a blueprint?
Absolutely. And from my memory, you know, we spent quite a lot of time at the business roundtable, you know, retreat. I mean, I was just one of the number of speakers that went there. And we laid out our view of where the country's going. And from memory, he was pretty supportive.
The Green Party has released a draft political positioning on paper. It's slightly open crack in the door to working with you guys. How do you feel about that? I mean, would you work with Greens?
Well, we currently do work with them. I mean, we have a memorandum of understanding. It's different from the supply and confidence, the supply agreements we have with other political parties. I mean, I guess the way I look at it says my reading of their statement is if the balance of power after the November 26th election is held by the Green Party, then it'll be a Labour government. I think what they are saying is if that's not the position, then they could countenance view where they might work in some form of national. But I think they made pretty clear their major allegiances are very much related.
Do you think it's been a success, the work that you have done with them, or is it sort of a little bit?
Well, I think it's worked quite well, actually. I mean, we've worked on a number of different initiatives together. I mean, the Heat Up New Zealand installation program has been very, very, very successful as a program. Sideways, actually, in the country, that sometimes the opinions expressed by some in this room is actually making good progress and doing well. There's been other things that we've worked on together in terms of pest control. So it's been a healthy relationship. We've met with them every couple of months.
How many jobs in the cycle we created so far?
359.
Do you think it's a shame that the Greens seem so reluctant to work with National? Because Conservative governments in Europe particularly work with Green parties and coalitions.
Yeah, look, I think that's a matter for them. But I think it's important to understand the Green Party in New Zealand is not purely an environmental party by any stretch of the imagination. They have a strong social agenda, and that is, I'd argue, actually linked to Labour's, and it has been for a long period of time. But certainly, as you can point out, in countries like Germany, the Green Party is very much held a balance of power, from pretty much as I understand it, seeing a group of a large environmental party has oscillated between left and right. All I can tell you is, from a National Party point of view, I think we're a political party that takes our environmental responsibilities seriously. A huge number of people vote for us would care deeply and passionately about the environment, and that's reflected in the fact that we've taken steps to address environmental concerns in lots of areas, whether it's national policy statements from the Minister for the Environment, right through the introduction of our version of the emissions trading scheme.
So would you compromise any more policy to form a government with Greens if they do have that balance?
I think it's a little bit early to sort of think about that. But I mean, I think the important takeaway point is, you know, while we're all out doing something with us post 2011, the clear allegiance is with that party and your
organisation. In terms of the budget, are you differentiating how you respond to the hole in the box that's caused by the economic slowdown vis-a-vis the hole in the box caused by sort of the one-off event that the crisis is going to use?
Look, not really. To be honest, there's a combination of things that impair the accounts. So the first is just we have to take, because of the accounting treatment, the shortfall between the anticipated income received on the back of insurance and reinsurance and private insurance vis-a-vis the total cost of rebuild. Second thing is anticipated reduction in tax revenue. And third is increased outgoings and programs specific to the Canberra earthquake, like the welfare support packages.
The reduction in tax revenue has been said to be perhaps $5 billion. Is that still the guess?
The latest numbers I've seen slightly lower than that.
$4
billion? Well, I think the original estimates were $3 to $5 billion. I don't, off the top of my head, have the numbers to hand, but $5 billion is definitely on the high side.
The Finance Minister last week said that high house prices could perhaps be detrimental to productivity and economic activity. Are you of the same inclination?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think housing affordability is, it's a critical issue in New Zealand. When you see New Zealand constantly, or New Zealand cities constantly being at the high end of that affordability index, it's important that people can house themselves and not consume all of their disposable income doing so. So I think it's right for the productivity commission to have that as one of the initial focuses.
Is it possible that house prices are too high in New Zealand for what we want?
There's been a lot of work done over the years. I mean, the previous government had DPNC lead the effort in terms of looking at those issues. There's a lot of different factors. We've addressed some of them, I think, in terms of reforms we're making to the Building Act, work we've done in terms of the Resource Management Act, there are other areas we've been addressing that. Obviously, housing is a lot more affordable at the moment under this government than it was under the previous government, simply because interest rates were a lot lower. Energy house prices are not rising, being a static, slightly negative.
Is the government open to more tax changes to that sort of housing and investment area?
Not looking at that at the moment, no.
Reserve banks introduced controls on rural lending. Do you have a view on the wisdom of that and whether or not that could be extended to housing lending?
I don't think that's new. I think that's something that they've been proposing for some time. And I think it reflected the view that they were concerned about the overall level of debt in the rural sector, given that it's highly susceptible to changes in commodity prices. Look, that's a matter for the Reserve Bank, but we expect them to manage the fragile nature of the financial ecosystem. That's what they look.
With the release of the government's energy strategy,
yes,
is it hypocritical for the government to pay lip service to using renewable energy when you're looking at using more coal and more oil?
Well, look, I think that, and I haven't had a good look through that, so I'm just aware that someone's put up on the website. But if it's the document that talking about, and I don't think it's even been through a cabinet, so it's a pretty early draft. My understanding is it's important to understand there's two things going on. One is the government's own energy usage, and we have a 90% renewables target, and actually, as a government, the ETS has seen more applications for new generation coming from renewables than any other sector. We've been heavily investing in areas like geothermal and wind. We're always looking for opportunities around hydro. So I think we remain very committed to using renewable energies. What the bit that you're talking about there is about New Zealand's exploration activity and what would then happen to that oil and gas. And that is destined primarily to export markets. Now, if you take the view that New Zealand shouldn't export coal because other countries might burn it, that's bad for the planet, that's a view you can take. But I think that's a bit of a stretch because on that basis, you know, if you eat too much cream, you get fat. no one's arguing that we shouldn't export cream. So, look, in the end, it's for others to determine what the right environmental policies are.
Can I just take back to a comment you made very early on about the welfare situation in Christchurch? You talked about a potential bulge there. Are there projections on this?
I don't have any numbers, no. That's why I think Clayton Cosgrove's just made up, so I haven't seen it.
I mean, shouldn't there be some work being done around this? It's a matter of weeks away that MSD is going to face potentially a massive influx of people going on to it.
Well, our capacity to handle people going on an unemployment benefit is without question. We have the capability from a lot that's done online. There's significant staff deployed there, so there's no issues in terms of that. So the challenge for the government isn't sort of around navel-gazing about how many people might come on unemployment benefit or not. I think the focus of the government should be on how we can keep as many people employed as we practically can, and that's where our focus of attention is. I can't tell you the final numbers, but I think with Christchurch, a lot of the numbers are very subjective. I mean, they are the best estimate that people have at the time.
The electricity market's been labelled as a bit of a joke at the moment with the price spike the other week, and private businesses are saying it's really hitting their books. Should government be stepping in to perhaps make...
Well, the Minister has, and the reforms that he has proposed hopefully help that situation, but I think all of us need to acknowledge it's a highly liquid market. It would be great if we had a liquid and deep market for hedging, but the reality is we don't. Okay, thank you.